Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and today's conversation is with Dr. David Hsu, Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness for the Department of Defense. And joining us on our conversation is Bill Phillips.
David, in the last segment, you clearly demonstrated a passion for the quality of life and the social compact with the military. Talk to us about education of children of military dependents.
Well, I think this is one of the sleeper issues out there, and it illustrates the fact that what people worry about in terms of quality of life shifts over time as the aspirations of Americans change. One of the things people aspire for now, as we all appreciate, is good quality education for their kids. We've done a terrific job overseas with the Department of Defense educational system. Our schools overseas, if we were a state and you gave us a standardized test, and we do take these tests like everybody else does, we'd be between 1 and 5 in the nation in terms of test score outcomes, which is I think, a terrific record. But as I go around the country and I ask people stationed at Base X or Camp Y, how's the school system? Too frequently, I get poor answers, or I get answers where you recognize from their behavior that they are not satisfied. We have, in many locations, people either living a fair way away from the base in order to find a school system that they find adequate for their kids, or actually sending their kids to private schools. And it's not just officers. We now have some senior enlisted personnel whom, while we pay them decently, I don't think we're really paying them a level where they can typically afford a private school, who are saying, I'm going to somehow find this money because the situation is unacceptable. This is a big issue for the department. The department, of course, should not be running schools in the United States. We do, for historical reasons, run a small set at a few bases around the country. But we shouldn't be in the schools business. That's a local responsibility. And one of our big challenges in the Department of Defense is to find a way to work with local communities so they can improve the school system for everyone, but importantly, including the children of our military personnel. Now, one of the improvements which we seek around all around the country, both from strong school systems as well as others, is being sure that they're sensitive to the needs of kids of families who move around a lot. One of the difficulties that occurs is, you know, tryouts for the sports are, let's say, the last week of August. Well, if you don't show up to September, you may not be considered by the school system. Likewise, each school system has its prerequisites in order to take the calculus course, let's say. Well, if you didn't quite meet those, you know, you might not get that chance. And so we've got an organized program, importantly advanced by Mrs. Reimer, the wife of a former Army Chief of Staff, to try to sensitize school systems and school system leaders to the need to think about how your rules will affect an important part of your student body in those communities with a lot of military children. And I'm delighted many school systems are responsive to that overture when we make it and start to think about how they could do things a little bit differently so that our kids have an equal chance as someone who has lived for 20 years in the same place. Some of it's hilarious, and the local school superintendent can't do anything about it. And one of the problems, as you know, in many school systems is you have to take a course on the history of the state in which you live. And some of our children have taken the history course for several states, which is more, I think, than anyone really anticipated.
Many have wondered, I think, about the relationship between the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, as I understand it, you're part of an executive council that's looking into the coordination between the two. I wonder if you could tell us about the goals of that council.
This is something that Leo McKay, the Veterans Affairs Department Deputy Secretary, and I put into place within the last year to respond to the President's interest in seeing better coordination between the two departments. We obviously share, in some sense, the same population. The veterans are all graduates, alumni, so to speak, of the Department of Defense. VA runs a big medical system, as we all know, of course, to deal with veterans' problems, which are somewhat different from the active force. In some locations, we have facilities in the same place. And so one obvious issue is, shouldn't we collaborate more? Shouldn't we find a way to work together? We also have issues of how we organize the benefit programs so it's easier for the veteran to deal with those programs. For example, could we not make the exit physical from the military the same physical that VA uses for assessment of disabilities? Well, in the past, the DoD physical didn't do all the tests the VA needs to have, so it's a matter of making sure that we have the same form, that the record can be read by both institutions, since all records are now increasingly electronic, and that we make sure we cover all the testings that VA has. Some of this is quite straightforward. Some of it's quite complex in terms of how we do things. And I'll give you an example. We already do a fair amount of business where they take care of our patient, we take care of their patient. An example in Honolulu is Tripler Army Hospital has a VA outpatient clinic on its grounds, and if you need inpatient care, you go to the Tripler Hospital. But each of these has to be crafted one by one as a separate agreement between the two institutions. A lot of argument what the costs are, who's supposed to pay for each element of cost. And what Dr. McCann and I agreed was let's find a way to cut through these arguments so that the two institutions can work together more easily. And so what we did was simply say, if you take care of my patient, there is an externally established schedule of prices. Essentially, it's an extension of the Medicare schedule. And we'll both agree to accept that because we ought to be able to meet and actually accept it minus 10% because there ought to be some savings here for the government, the taxpayer. And let's not argue over exactly whether I used one more bandage on your patient than would be normal, and therefore I got to charge you a little extra. It'll all come out in the wash in the end. And the idea behind this is to release the energies of the local leaders so they can come to the agreements, which they typically seek and want, because they want to do the best thing for their patient population.
David, let's shift and talk about the future. You talked earlier about the challenge of the pending retirement over the next number of years, significant people leaving. As you look out, what are the most significant personnel and readiness issues and challenges that you face and the department faces?
It's how you sustain the contemporary success of the volunteer force. As American society changes, the aspirations of young people change, and as we're conducting a probably long-term global war on terrorism. This is not a short conflict. This is a long-haul event, much like the Cold War in some respects, I think is the way we ought to think about it. That ought to be our mindset. And how do you keep this force, as it is today, the best military in the world? Importantly, because it's got the best people in it, and they are motivated and properly trained to do their job. And that's the other big challenge. How units will operate in the future, as I think operations in Afghanistan demonstrated, is going to be very different from the past. It's a much more, as the military likes to say, joint operation. So you had Army Special Forces operatives on the ground calling in airstrikes from Air Force and Navy aircraft. And we don't practice enough for real, so to speak, in peacetime and in peacetime settings with those kinds of joint operations. Not the services don't work together well, not they can't work together, not they can't improvise well, but our standard is and should be not to improvise. In other words, this should be second nature. It shouldn't be, okay, I've got to solve this problem on the aircraft on the way to the theater because I'm now facing the enemy. I should have done this over and over so it's automatic, so I know what I'm doing, and I know how to work with someone from a different service, a different kind of weapon system that my own service provides. And providing that joint national training capability is one of the Deputy Secretary's premier objectives. My orders are, stand this up by 1 October 2004.
Given all the conflicts you alluded to, what's going to happen to the size of the Department of Defense?
Our expectation is the number of people in active service will probably be relatively constant over the foreseeable future. Indeed, really, it's a challenge the Secretary has issued to the Department. Don't just solve the problems, react to pressures of the present day by adding without thinking about what you're going to subtract. In other words, if I have a new high priority mission, what older mission that maybe isn't quite so important can I take off the table? What can I stop doing? And why does the Secretary want to do that? Obvious reason, we do not have an unlimited budget. Although we have a big budget, there is a constraint out there. And the Secretary has to do two things with the budget. He has to win the current conflict and he has to invest in those transformational articles that will change the face of the Department of the Future. If he allows new missions simply to be added on top of everything else we're doing, he'll never have any money with which to transform. And so my clear instructions are, figure out what we can drop off, what's low priority, what doesn't have a real payoff in this environment, which might include civilianizing the function, which might include going to a contractor to provide that function. The constant question I'm charged with examining is, does this need to be a uniformed person, which is our most expensive resource in the department.
What advice would you give to a young person who's now considering an opportunity for career service?
Well, first of all, I'd congratulate him or her because I think it's a terrific choice. Second, I'd emphasize, pick something that interests you. Because if you don't have a passion for it, if you don't enjoy it, if you don't like it, there are a lot of vicissitudes that come with public service. There are a certain number of burdens. I don't want to be naive about this. And so you've got to love what you're doing. I think it's less important to chart a career in some kind of managed sense. If you do well, my take on the federal government, at least, if you do well, you'll get a great chance, a great set of chances. So start with something interesting. Start with a set of issues that turns you on. Start with a set of people that you like to work with, especially pick a boss that you respect and that you think you can learn from, and it'll take care of itself from there.
Well, David, we're out of time. Bill and I want to thank you for being with us this morning.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Dr. David Chu of the Department of Defense. Be sure and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's very interesting conversation. Again, that's businessofgovernment.org. This is Paul Lawrence. See you next week.